and a warm welcome to the debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. In a forum held here in Tehran, Iran's top diplomat Mohammad Javad Zarif criticized extra-regional powers as a source of instability in this region. He took a jab at the U.S., whose military presence he believes has brought insecurity to West Asia. The Syrian foreign minister also criticized the U.S. for occupying Syrian soil and backing terrorists fighting the Damascus government. American officials have admitted having wasted $7 trillion in this region. Now, in tonight's debate show, we'll review the U.S. military intervention in the region since two decades ago in such countries as Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Sudan, and Libya.
The fundamental question, though, is...
Iran's foreign minister says interventions by outside powers, especially by the U.S., are the main cause of instability in the West Asia region. Mohammad Javad Zarif made the comment during the second Tehran Dialogue Forum. During his address, Zarif also talked about the reshaping of the region, but noted that such a move requires the identification of principal causes of the problems.
The U.S. has exacerbated the insecurity and instability of this region more than any other region. As its own figures suggest, some $7 trillion have been wasted on forever wars and military interventions in this region.
The top Iranian diplomat underlined that the U.S. interventions are aimed at dominating the region. He said the region has turned into a military zone for the U.S. and its allies through their troop presence and arms sales to certain states. Addressing the Tehran Dialogue Forum, Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad highlighted the U.S. occupation of his country. He said that Washington formed a coalition under the pretext of fighting terrorism, but its main agenda was to attack Syria and threaten other regional countries.
The United States and the European Union, or the leading countries in the European Union, are using this coalition to attack Syria, to threaten other independent countries in the region, and to claim that they are fighting against Daesh. Daesh, in fact, has been encouraged and supported by the United States.
Years of devastation in Syria caused by the U.S. and its allies with their backing to terror groups are just the tip of the iceberg. U.S. interventionist agenda in other countries such as Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, and Libya all show that Washington wants to destabilize West Asia to dominate it. However, such stance has simply ignited anti-U.S. sentiment across many countries. In Iraq, protests against the presence of American troops and a parliamentary resolution for the expulsion of all U.S. troops last year are part of the sentiment. Calls grew louder after the U.S. assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in a drone attack in January last year. The U.S. too has come to a conclusion that its West Asia policies have been a complete failure. Last week, the U.S. government, for the first time, acknowledged that the Yemen war has no military solution. Secretary of State Antony Blinken also told UN Special Envoy for Yemen, Martin Griffiths, that diplomatic efforts should be redoubled with the help of the UN and other players to end the Yemen war. But shouldn't Washington be blamed for the Yemen carnage, as it's been the main supplier of arms to Saudi Arabia and its allies that invaded the impoverished nation? But the U.S. views the West Asia region as a military zone, and what matters to Washington most is making profit out of chaos and conflicts, for it can sell more weapons to the rich Arab states.
Now let me now introduce our guests in this debate show tonight. We'll have executive from the Executive Intelligence Review, we have Bill Jones in Leesburg, and also editor of the Veterans Today, Mike Harris in Phoenix. Good to have you both gentlemen on the show. Now let me start by going to Leesburg to Bill Jones. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says that interventions by the U.S. are the main cause of instability in the West Asia region. What do you think is the underlying reason for Washington's interference in this part of the world, which certainly began after the Second World War?
Well, basically, it's been the fact since the death of Franklin Roosevelt,
Well, unfortunately, we have a little technical glitch with Leesburg. Let me go to Phoenix and ask Mike Harris. Mike, West Asia has become a military zone. for the U.S. and its allies through their troop presence and arms sales to certain states. Afghanistan, Iraq, Yemen, Syria, Sudan, and Libya are among a long list of military interventions. Why does the U.S. insist on destabilizing this region? Is it because of the oil or because of Israel's security?
No, I think it's because the U.S. Foreign policy has been captured by the interest of Israel. You have to remember that the U.S. Has a very powerful Israeli lobby, and that they influence U.S. political positions both domestically and foreign. There is no upside for the U.S. as a nation to go in and participate militarily in the destruction of the Middle East. This is purely to fortify Israel's position and to buy them a false sense of security. Really, this needs to be done, demonstrated. Under the direction of former President Trump, we saw a great deal of downsizing and withdrawal from both Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan, and that has been immediately reversed under the Biden administration. And so although Donald Trump was very friendly and pro-Israel on a number of fronts and areas, he was also very pro-America to get America from wasting its resources and fighting these endless wars. Under the previous administration before Trump, under Obama, you had the U.S. actually funding terrorist activities. I was in Syria during 2014, 15, and again in 16, and I actually saw captured U.S. munitions, towed missiles that are made by Raytheon Corporation in Tucson, Arizona, that had been captured by the Syrian Arab Army, and recorded the serial numbers on these things, referred them to Department of State and a number of other things. So, U.S. resources that were being given to Syria, the good terrorists, the pro-American rebels, if you will, mm-hmm. Were actually being diverted and given to Daesh and to ISIS themselves.
Okay.
So the U.S. foreign policy over there, again, has been captured by the Israelis.
Yeah. And welcome to countries one by one. Okay. Now, let's go to Leesburg. Hopefully that sound problem with Leesburg is solved. Bill Jones, you were talking about the underlying reason for Washington's interference in this region.
Well, primarily since the end of the Second World War, there was an attempt by the British Empire, especially after the death of Franklin Roosevelt. And remember, Roosevelt was the first one to be involved in the Middle East when he met with Abdulaziz in Saudi Arabia during the war. But Roosevelt's idea was to go back to the region after the war and to irrigate the desert. He died. Truman came in. Truman became a puppet of Winston Churchill, and the United States began to adopt the role that the British Empire had had in the previous century to be the policeman of the world. That role was contested by President Trump, as the former speaker said. But there was a general agreement within the political establishment, heavily influenced by this British ideology, that the United States must remain the number one power in the world. That is now specifically named as U.S. policy. And in doing that, it intervenes, has to intervene in all these areas, not because of what's happening so much in the region itself. As we see in Syria, as we see in Iraq, the United States is also there to counter Russian influence, in the case of Iraq, to counter Chinese influence. And the big game is really between the major powers, that the United States is not prepared to accept another major power with which it can work, with which it can reconcile and operate together with, and so that they're conducting operations, some of which are surrogate warfare, involving other peoples, but is directly aimed at countering one of the other major powers. And this has been the case in the Middle East for some time. And we look at the U.S., what the foreign minister said was on the mark, that everybody knows that when the U.S. went into Iraq, this was the real beginning of the troubles in the Middle East, which had previously been problematic, but not so violent. After that, it became hell on earth.
Okay. Now, Mike, you were talking about Syria, and we had the Syrian foreign minister, Mr. Faisal Miqdad, telling the Tehran Dialogue Forum here today that Washington formed a coalition under the pretext of fighting terrorism, but its main agenda was to attack Syria and also threaten other regional countries. Let's have your take on that.
will. But that's absolutely correct. And trying to remember who the general was who stated about a decade or so ago that the U.S. had plans to topple seven countries in the Middle East, and Syria was on that list. Mm-hmm. And so you know, that hasn't changed. Well, the problem we have is that the U.S. foreign policy is not directed by the officials who are elected. U.S. foreign policy has got an established State Department cadre in there that hasn't changed or turned over in decades. And they're conducting their own foreign policy against the wishes of the American people. This was demonstrated very clearly by the election of Donald Trump and the changes that he tried to make by withdrawing U.S. forces out of the Middle East, and was thwarted nearly at every turn. So it just shows that the deep state is at work in the State Department, as well as the DOJ and other corrupted organizations in the U.S. government. And you have to realize that the U.S. government is functioning currently as a captured operation by foreign powers. And so Israel comes to mind, and as Mr. Jones, I think, from EIR stated, under British influence as well. And so the U.S. has to reevaluate its position and put our elected form of government back into the power of the true republic, and stop this deep state manipulation of what we're doing. Because most Americans have no issue, they have no desire to embrace the globalist agenda. And so they wish to break free of that and you'll function as a truly sovereign nation again. But the foreign minister of Iran was correct in his statement that U.S. is meddling in Syria. And I spoke with some people who are friendly with me from the Russian Foreign Ministry, and their view on this is that the road to Moscow goes through first Damascus, then Tehran, then into Moscow. And so the Russians have a very solid interest in protecting their southern flank. And so they're going to oppose anyone who tries to use the terrorism as a surrogate war fighting mechanism in order to bring chaos and regime change to that region.
Okay, now, Bill, let's take a look at Afghanistan now. Close to two decades passed since American forces decided their military intervention there to restore, as they call it, peace. Still, violence is claiming innocent civilian lives, and insecurity is rampant. How do you evaluate the U.S. presence in Afghanistan?
It's extremely problematic, and it has been from the get-go. There may have been a reason going in there directly after 9/11, but staying there now for how many, 14, 15 years, is a no-win situation. You don't want chaos in Afghanistan, but you can't prevent chaos by simply having American troops there. The solution would have to be that the United States would have to get together not only with the Afghanis, but also with the countries in the region who border Afghanistan, that is including India, including China, to try and bring to bear the influence that these different countries have on that situation to create some form of economic development. But the U.S. refuses to do that by and large because it feels that it has to be the policeman of the world and therefore has to take the point on this. It's what, like I said, what the British used to do in Afghanistan. They had the same role in Afghanistan in the 19th century, and they dealt with the same problems. If the U.S. would go back to its own tradition, if it would go back to the tradition of an independent republic and not as a imperial enforcer, it would be able to deal with these situations diplomatically by bringing in other countries with influence and not trying to do everything themselves by shedding the blood and the treasure of the American people. We really had a glimpse of that during the Trump administration, although he seemed to be overwhelmed by the neocons that he unfortunately brought with him. But that's really where the American people are. But as your other speaker said, the political establishment is heavily influenced by what's called the Anglo-American relationship. And that relationship is such that the British see themselves as the brain and the United States as the brawn. Mm-hmm. If we break with that and again use our own brains to develop our own policy instead of following in the old imperial way, we'd probably be able to deal with the problems of the world much more effectively.
Mm-hmm. Mike, Washington also invaded Iraq and removed its ally, the Iraqi strongman Saddam Hussein, on unfounded claims of presence of weapons of mass destruction in that country. Now, to spend big bucks, as you know, setting up the big, beautiful military bases in Iraq, as Mr. Trump put it, and now Iraqi parliamentarians want American forces out, but they're turning a deaf ear. Tell us about the repercussions of U.S. intervention in Iraq.
Well, the repercussions of U.S. intervention in Iraq is they destabilize the entire region. That's the major repercussion. You know, the U.S. government lies about virtually everything to the American people and to the rest of the world. They try to create the fraud of, you know, weapons of mass destruction to justify going in there after they allege that Saddam Hussein somehow had participated in 9/11, which is another fraud upon the American people and the world. You know, the real perpetrators of 9/11 are still walking around out there and have never been brought to justice. You know, no one believes that 19 Arabs with box cutters actually brought down the Twin Towers. So, you know, we've got some fundamental flaws, and we're essentially, the U.S. is being run by a bunch of gangsters right now. We have been for a very long time. And they have, as I said, captured the operations of our government. Mm-hmm. And it's time for the American people to stand up and demand change on this. Because we can't go on doing criminal activities around the world. If you look at the example of Afghanistan, the opium traffic was the lowest under the Taliban, and it's the highest under the U.S. occupation.
Exactly.
The reason the U.S. is still there, 19 going on 20 years later, is because the opium profits are so outstanding and so great that they fund all the black programs that the CIA and the deep state want to fund anything in the world that they want to do. They have the funds to do it. And so they're never going to leave Afghanistan until we, the people of the United States, drag them out of their positions of power and reform our own government from within. And, the fact that the Democrat cheating in this last election has gone unchallenged is just, offensive to most of us Americans here. But we really need to get back. Who runs this country? Are we truly a democratic republic where the people's vote counts and we have a voice in our government? Or have we been hijacked, and are we being run by this deep state criminal gangster operation?
Right.
That's the question that the people of the United States have to ask, and that's the question that the other governments of the world have to ask when dealing with the United States.
Yep, good
because
question.
It is very obvious to all of us who live here that we are no longer a Democrat Republic, and we've got to take that back. We have to take that to them. And all of these other problems, whether in the Middle East or everywhere else in the world, they will resolve themselves.
Okay, I'm sorry, we're running out of time. So I have one more question for Bill. Another country in the region is Yemen, which has been under the U.S. drone strikes and a U.S.-backed Saudi-led war for 6 years. And rights groups have complained about the use of American-made weaponry and ammunition in the impoverished country. Yet it doesn't seem that the U.S. would stop the lucrative sale of weapons to Saudi child killers. Is Washington not an accomplice to crimes committed in Yemen?
Absolutely the case. There has been, one could call it genocide against the Yemeni population to the extent that food supplies for many of the people who are homeless there have been restricted by the Saudi operations, and that the U.S. has been playing softball with the Saudis. Even the latest case of the Khashoggi murder, which the Biden administration released the report on the fact that the number two man and maybe the number one man in Saudi Arabia was responsible for that, but they didn't hold him responsible because the Saudi relationship, the oil relationship, and the political relationship seems to be a number one importance to the U.S. in maintaining hegemony in the region. And the weapon sale, of course, to the Saudis is a part of using them in this game and letting them run free when necessary and trying to keep them under control otherwise. But it's been a mess, and Yemen is a tragedy, and I think it's, to call it a genocide is directly on the mark, and there should be war crimes trials for that.
Okay, and that note, we come to the end of this debate. Thank you, my guests from the Executive Intelligence Review. We had Bill Jones in Leesburg, and also editor of the Veterans Today, Mike Harris, who joined us out of Phoenix with a comments and contribution. Thank you.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, health is a blessing. Brothers and sisters, we know that Allah has bestowed countless blessings on us. And one of those remarkable blessings is our health, right? We're living, we're breathing, our body parts, our limbs, they're all active. The Quran and the instructions of Prophet and Ahlul Bayt contain teachings which show every Muslim how to protect his health generally and how to take care of each of his organs. Numerous examples can be given. Prominent among these is wudu, the ablution, which Islam regards as compulsory whenever it is invalidated. We are strongly recommended to repeat it in many cases and situations. Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam has said, "The door to prayer is opened with purification." And another version of this same hadith is, "The door to prayer is opened with ablutions." Indeed, the Prophet used to perform his ablutions for every single prayer. He used to say, "Only a believer maintains his ablutions," and also, ablution is part of being faithful. Moreover, a person who is in a state of ritual impurity after sexual intercourse, the janaba, is recommended to perform ablutions if he wants to eat or to go to bed, and let's say they don't have to take the ritual ghusl and the shower at that time. So see how Islam is providing us with different ways of maintaining this health, the physical health, right? Our organs and our physical purification. Why? Because it is one of the greatest blessings Allah has given all of us. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing that health is a blessing. It is one of the most remarkable blessings that Allah has given to us all. And unfortunately, many a times we become negligent and don't pay attention to what He has given us. Health is indeed a favor that we take for granted. We should express gratitude to Allah for bestowing us with health, and we should try our utmost to look after it. Allah has entrusted us with our bodies for a predestined period of time. He will hold us to account on how we looked after and utilized our bodies and good health. Diet and nutrition play a big part in maintaining the best possible health. You know, so does a lifestyle in incorporating, let's say, exercise, right? And eating healthy. Islam lays emphasis on a simple diet combined with physical exercise, fulfilling the obligations of three of the five pillars of Islam. Requires that Muslims be of sound health and fitness. The daily performance of five prayers is in itself a form of exercise, in addition to, of course, that spiritual connection with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and that state of heart that has to connect with Allah. The side product of it is that you're physically active now, right? The prescribed movements of a person, while he's praying, involve all the muscles and joints of the body, and concentration in prayer relieves mental stress. All of these are the benefits, the side benefits of prayers, and we know the real benefit of prayer is that we are obligated to be in touch and in contact with our Creator and our Lord, who has given us all these blessings. So remember, your health is important. It is one of the astonishing blessings of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Nowruz is the most widely celebrated holiday in the Islamic Republic of Iran. It means new day that marks the first day of spring. The holiday, which usually falls on or around March 21st, is widely celebrated across the West and Central Asia. Iran's foreign ministry invited the envoys of the Nowruz region to mark the event. Held in the presence of ambassadors, Iran's foreign minister Mohammad Javad Zarif congratulated the arrival of spring.
The lesson that all must learn is that there is only a superpower in the world, and that is the Almighty God. There is no other superpower in the world. Those who were boasting of their military, economic, and scientific power all were defeated by a tiny virus.
Iran's Minister of Cultural Heritage, Tourism and Handicrafts, Ali Asghar Mounesan, and Minister of Science, Research and Technology, Mansour Ghulami, also attended the ceremony and made a short speech. Mexico's ambassador to Tehran said, Nowruz is very similar to traditions in Mexico.
La verdad es que estoy muy, muy conmovido.
Nowruz is very interesting to me. Few people in Mexico know about this celebration. I see a very happy atmosphere in Tehran, especially since you are apparently entering the new century. Another thing that caught my attention is the human relations that take place during the Nowruz celebrations, which is very similar to the celebrations in Mexico. For example, the whole family goes shopping for New Year here, and it is the same way in Mexico.
Some traditional musical bands from across Iran performed some pieces for the visitors. A half-scene sofra was also set in the iconic Mashq Square to mark the festivity of Nowruz. The message of Nowruz, which is revival and a new life, was also projected on a historic building inside the ministry complex via video mapping.
Over 300 million people celebrate Nowruz across the globe. In Iran, it is the most important holiday that marks the beginning of the new year. Nowruz has been celebrated in Iran for over 3,000 years. Humam Abedi, Tehran.
The debate over the policing of a London vigil on March 13th for Sarah Everard, a 33-year-old woman allegedly kidnapped and murdered by a serving British police officer earlier this month, is ongoing. What had been a peaceful and respectful demonstration of female solidarity turned ugly. Police moved in, pushing and shoving the demonstrators, and took away some of the women in handcuffs.
I've never been in a situation like this before, so I just thought, well, if I just don't say anything, I'm not sure what to do. But, you know, I just stood there, and I know someone was, a police officer was pulling my arm, trying to get my name, and then all of a sudden, I was tackled to the ground.
The sight of women who had come to stand together against male violence being manhandled led to a chorus of criticism from across the political spectrum. Attention soon shifted to this woman, Metropolitan Police Commissioner Cressida Dick, forced to explain her officer's actions to the authorities and to defend herself.
I don't think anybody who was not in the operation can actually pass a detailed comment on the rightness and wrongness of it.
She has so far rejected calls for her resignation from those she described as armchair critics who believe police handling of the vigil was heavy-handed. But she has the backing of the government. Prime Minister Boris Johnson says he has full confidence in her. In fact, the force she leads may be getting the powers she asked for after the Extinction Rebellion protests of 2019, a new law and order bill. Critics, among them conservative MPs, have called it a mess and an attack on people's right to protest.
300 or so pages, 170-something clauses, and almost nothing, if you can believe it, on violence against women and girls. The gaping hole in this bill is why we'll be voting against it.
The main focus of the criticism of the bill is its wording. For example, it gives the police the power to impose conditions on processions and public assemblies if the noise generated by the persons taking part may result in serious disruption to the activities of an organization which are carried out in the vicinity.
I'm really worried about it. It gives the police a lot of powers to decide what they think is an unacceptable protest, powers that can be decided later in law. It's not very clear. Just their conception of what might be a public annoyance or nuisance is potentially going to be a reason to shut down a protest and for prison sentences of up to 10 years. That's a bit of an assault on democracy.
Just imagine going to jail for making noise or causing inconvenience. The British government will have some tough questions to answer from MPs on its new policing bill, such as how it defines such unspecified terms as noise or serious inconvenience, and how giving sweeping, ill-defined powers to the police will affect freedom of expression in this country. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Based on a report by Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission, over 100 civilians, including women and children, were killed or wounded over the last 6 days alone. The rights body called international community to put pressure on both warring sides, mainly the Taliban, to reduce violence.
As our findings show, 13 civilians, including women and children, were killed and 93 others were wounded due to rising violence across the country only over the past 6 days. Therefore, we seriously call on the international community and other rights bodies to do whatever they can to put an end to misery of war-weary Afghans.
This comes as both the Afghan government and the Taliban accuse each other of targeting civilians, but facts on the ground show that terrorist groups such as Daesh and Taliban are responsible for much of civilian casualties.
There are multiple reasons in civilian casualties, such as terrorist attacks, the proxy wars, or unknown elements that are still in equations. But the war in Afghanistan is a complicated and bland as ever. People are still dying, life is still being torn apart, and the nation, global powers, most importantly, the people of Afghanistan are being drawn further into a situation that is hard to see a way of it.
However, the NATO troops are also accused of targeting civilian gatherings, such as wedding parties and religious events. This comes as despite all political attempts to bring stability to Afghanistan, this is the Afghans who rarely bear the brunt of violence. Local Afghans say they welcome any agreement that leads the country to calm and security.
Afghan civilians lose their lives on a daily basis while the country's peace process is going to enter a new phase. The launch of separate summits in Russia and Turkey to discuss the fate of the peace process. Will those conferences bring peace to Afghanistan? Let's wait and see. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The immense bloc of anti-aggression parties has held a symposium in the capital Sana'a to discuss the repercussions of the Takfiri organization's presence in the country. It comes as the army pushes its offensive to liberate the province of Marib from terrorist groups.
This event is to inform the Yemenis of the danger of the foreign presence and terrorist organizations, especially in the southern governorates, and it coincides with the continuing battle of Marib, which has led to mass flight of terrorists from areas previously controlled by Saudi Arabia and the UAE.
The participants in the symposium said foreign forces, including those of Saudi Arabia and the UAE, are the main supporters of the terrorists in different parts of the country. The participants called for purging Marib from Takfiri terrorists.
Everyone knows that the terrorism in the Arab world is rooted in the Wahhabi ideology and is waged with the support of Saudi Arabia. The country is still the center of terrorism, and other countries have joined it, trying to spread these ideas among Muslims. The US and Britain are sponsoring these terrorists and exploiting them against axes of resistance to spread chaos in countries which oppose US policies in the region.
Saudi Arabia has led a US-backed aggression on Yemen since the beginning of 2015 that has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis and has also unleashed terrorists backed by Riyadh and its allies on the war-torn country. Yemenis believe that Riyadh wants to keep a hand on oil-rich provinces of their country, especially Marib. They say Saudis are advancing their agenda by backing terrorist groups with money and weapons. Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
On March 13th, then-United States President Donald Trump declared the coronavirus to be a national emergency. 1 year later, many believe that the world's richest country has had the world's worst national response to the pandemic. At over a half million fatalities, the U.S. has twice as many deaths as the second hardest-hit nation, Brazil. Many attribute that to the U.S. being alone among developed nations in having an almost entirely for-profit healthcare system.
It's been an extremely tough year, which is atrocious for the richest country on Earth. You know, China and much of Southeast Asia have managed to control the virus. Much poorer countries, Australia and New Zealand, which are, you know, English-speaking capitalist countries, have managed to contain the virus. So the U.S. response is, you know, from the government's really pathetic at this point.
The U.S. emulated China's example by calling for lockdowns, but they came without the governmental safety net nor the cultural solidarity which such mass quarantines seem to require. The resulting economic and personal devastation is still too enormous to be fully grasped, but the lockdowns clearly penalized the lower classes the most, caused inequality to soar, and resulted in the nation's worst economic situation since the Great Depression. The virus hit poor and non-white communities disproportionately hard, and then when the U.S. developed vaccines, these communities have been disproportionately excluded from receiving them.
A major reason for the poor U.S. response is, you know, how decentralized and dysfunctional the system is. And on the other hand, the lack of, you know, a militant, independent working class movement to really fight and demand those things that people in other countries are getting. If we had that sort of militant working class organization, we could have made those demands. The ruling class, the capitalists, would have probably conceded more.
The pandemic came amid, or maybe contributed to, major social protests towards racist policing, a bitterly disputed presidential election, and the hardening of unprecedented social divisions over the past year. The United States has pinned its recovery not on making structural changes, but on the vaccines that they have been able to produce. Should the vaccines fail to prevent a third major corona wave this spring, the resulting socioeconomic and cultural disaster would reach uncharted territory. Rami Mazahari, Chicago.
This feral jaded out. These words sound meaningless to ordinary people, but to every thalassemia patient, they are lifesavers. In fact, they're the drugs that chronically transfused patients use to remove excess iron from their bodies. Otherwise, they would die. According to experts at this conference in Tehran, Iran needs to import 17 million doses of these two drugs annually to supply its thalassemia patients. But only 2 million doses make their way into the country. The problem is U.S. sanctions. According to Iran's Thalassemia Society, since the U.S. reimposed sanctions against Iran in 2018, 187 thalassemia patients have lost their lives simply because the bans denied them access to life-saving medicine.
Since the U.S. reinstated the anti-Iran sanctions, 7,000 of them have lost their access to necessary medicine, and many of them have died.
Thalassemia patients are not the only victims of U.S. sanctions. People with EB, which is a severe skin condition, are also faced with drug shortage. Hadi is among the 800 EB patients in Iran, to whom sanction is an unending nightmare.
One in every 50,000 people contracts EB, which is known as a butterfly disease, so it's a rare condition, and so is its medicine in Iran. We're constantly on the lookout for the drugs to arrive, or else painful blisters will develop on our skin.
U.S. sanctions do not directly target Iran's medical sector, but the banking sanctions make it impossible for Iran to pay for any medical item it would buy from foreign firms. World leaders have time and again called on Washington to exempt humanitarian supplies from the list of its anti-Iran sanctions, but to no avail.
U.S. sanctions are inhuman and illegal. Washington says it is targeting the Iranian government, but they are targeting the Iranian people.
Iranian human rights officials say U.S.'s rights violations against Iranians has been kept under the rug for decades. The bitter reality, they say, has come to light during the coronavirus pandemic, when American officials continued the ban against Iran.
Medical supplies and food cannot be banned. It's a violation of all international laws to ban such items. But unfortunately, we see that the U.S. and EU have continued their illegal sanctions against Iranians to achieve their political interests.
When it comes to the COVID vaccine, the World Health Organization has launched the so-called COVAX initiative to ensure fair distribution of vaccines across the world. Officials here believe a similar initiative needs to be put in place by the WHO for other pharmaceuticals to ensure equal access to life-saving medicine across the world, far from any political agenda.
Hadi is one of the countless instances of the humanitarian side effects of U.S. sanctions against Iran. Rights activists say the ultimate solution lies in the hands of world leaders to avoid holding innocent lives hostage for their political gains. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Hospitals across the occupied West Bank are full, and intensive care units operating at over 100% capacity as the number of the coronavirus patients in some cities are growing significantly. A new field hospital is set to open near occupied city of Ramallah, and some parks will be converted to field hospitals as well in an attempt to cope with the new wave of infections.
The number of patients exceeds the capacity of hospitals, in particular, the capacity of the oxygen generators as well as the beds. We've opened new wards as the situation has deteriorated, but the wards open and the numbers continue to rise. We're at 100% capacity in general, even at 110%. and capacity in some hospitals. That's why there's an urgent need for field hospitals, and we have information that the work will start in 2 days.
Palestinian Health Minister May Al-Kayla said earlier that the West Bank is facing a third wave of the pandemic. The Palestinian government has imposed new restrictions, including the closure of schools and universities, but it seems that measures have failed to quell rising infections among the Palestinians.
The situation is very difficult. It can be described as an unprecedented coronavirus cases spike. We were hoping not to open field hospitals, but to witness an end to this virus. After recommendations from Health Directorate and the Ministry of Health, there is an urgent need for a serious position from all the Palestinians. After 1 year, they should completely abide by the measures.
People of the West Bank demand the Palestinian Authority to import vaccines. However, the PA has managed to acquire only a few thousand doses of vaccines, not even enough for frontline health workers. As observers say, the gap between Israel and the Palestinians has illustrated the global inequity between rich and poor nations in terms of access to vaccines. UN officials and the human rights groups have expressed concerns over the disparity, saying Israel is an occupying power that is responsible for the well-being of the Palestinians.
1 year on, the COVID-19 still rages on in the occupied West Bank, with hospitals filled up amid shortage of medical equipment. This has led the Palestinian Authority to adopt new measures, including strict lockdown, to cope with the new wave of the pandemic. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Refugee camp in the suburbs of New Delhi is gripped in utter panic and despair after hundreds were rounded last week and detained in Jammu region of Indian-controlled Jammu and Kashmir for possible deportation, according to police and local administration there.
We have no idea of what will happen to us. We are living here peacefully. We will survive on just one meal a day, but we urge the Indian government not to deport us because the military there will kill us. We are thankful to have got shelter in India. At least we are alive.
Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Estimates suggest some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living across different states of India.
Anti-Rohingya sentiments have been rising in India since the emergence of the Hindu nationalist government of the Bharatiya Janata Party in 2014. The ruling party calls the Rohingya people illegal immigrants and a security threat. Many vicious anti-Rohingya campaigns in the Jammu region also called for their expulsion a few years ago, leaving the community in great distress.
Fearing arrest and possible detention, many have gone into hiding, while others are in panic. Activists say it's unfair to detain or deport them, considering the situation in their country.
Already the refugees have started calling me up, and many have already sent me messages on the phone, apprehending danger to themselves and their community. We will take to both national and international campaigning to safeguard the security, dignity, and safety of the Rohingya refugees, as well as all other refugees in India.
Human Rights Watch and other rights groups have urged India to halt any deportation plan, saying conditions in Myanmar are not conducive. They say the Indian government should uphold its international law obligations and protect those in need of refuge within its borders. India has hosted refugees from many countries since decades, but adopted an aggressive approach towards Rohingya Muslims in particular. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
In a rarely seen demonstration of unity, the French Solidarity Movement with Palestine showed its support for Olivia Zemmour, one of the pillars of the BDS movement. Olivia will be judged next week for her participation in BDS actions. The official accusation, anti-Semitism, an insult towards a foreign state. BDS stands for Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Against Israel.
There is no legal base to condemn me, and therefore I hope that the judges will remain independent from the political powers.
By the way, the French state accepts boycott actions against China, Corsica, or against Russia and Iran. They accept that Brigitte Bardot boycotts Canadian products because of mistreating seals. But if we boycott Israel, they say it's discrimination.
The French government is acting against an important resolution of the European Court of Human Rights. This court decided in June last year that BDS is a legal political movement and obliged the French state to pay 100,000 euros to falsely condemned BDS activists. However, the French Justice Minister, Éric Dupond-Moretti, gave instructions to prosecutors, magistrates and judges in France to condemn appeals to boycott Israeli products. Since 2005, Olivia Zemmour is one of the main organizers of the BDS campaign in France, with remarkable actions in supermarkets. These kind of actions were considered worldwide as keystones and have been copied in many other countries. Other type of actions were held in official institutions like the French Football Federation to protest against the silence of Europe when Israel jailed, injured or killed footballers in Gaza. A third type of actions were protests when delegations to Palestine were withheld by Air France under direct Israeli pressure.
BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions Campaign, it's very important for us as a Jewish organization to support Palestinian rights, to tell Israel that it must respect international law and that it can't get away with murder. It can't get away with just anything. And this fallacious accusation of anti-Semitism just doesn't hold water.
Today, Israel considers the BDS campaign as a real danger for its propaganda system. Therefore, it uses all kinds of pressure on Western states to criminalize it. But the Palestinian Solidarity Movement stands still and alert. As observers say, if the French government wanted to respect the recommendation of the European Court of Human Rights, it would simply cancel this trial against an important BDS activist. Chris Denant, Paris.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's to my brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother. I'm Muhammad, and today I'm going to read to you an aphorism of Imam Ali from Nahjul Balagha. Before that, let's go ahead and listen to the Arabic words, and after that, I'm going to read you the English translation. Stay with us.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: من أطاع التواني ضيع الحقوق، ومن أطاع الواشي ضيع الصديق.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam said, "He who is a sluggard loses his rights, and he who believes in the backbiter loses his friend."
Back, dear listeners, it's a blessing to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, the son of Abu Talib alayhi salam. So one of the great lessons which we learn from Imam Ali alayhi salam is that the words and the statements of Imam Ali are so very profound and beautiful and all-encompassing that really every single one of us should try to find time to read the words and the statements of this great disciple and most perfect student of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Now, one of the ways in which we can read the words and the statements of Imam Ali alayhi salam and really take a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali is to read the Nahjul Balagha, the compilation of letters and sermons and statements of Imam Ali alayhi salam. In English, it is known as the Peak of Eloquence, and truly this compilation of the words and statements and sermons and letters of Imam Ali contain the answers to various mysteries. It contains the solutions to humanity's problems. It contains encouraging and motivational words, as well as profound admonishments. It contains the insight into the reality of history, and it contains insight into the reality of reality. Talking about Nahjul Balagha, we find that both Muslim and non-Muslim scholars have greatly praised this book, which contains the words and statements of Imam Ali. Non-Muslim scholars who have praised the Nahjul Balagha, the Peak of Eloquence, can be listed as George Jordak, or Professor Madelong, or Professor Lalani, or Professor Henry Corbin. And as well as these Muslim and non-Muslim scholars, we find that Shia and Sunni scholars have also greatly praised the Nahjul Balagha. Namely, we find that the Sunni scholar Fakhruddin Razi is one of those Sunni scholars who has written a sharah, an exposition upon Nahjul Balagha, and he has truly praised these words. It is unanimous between the Muslim and non-Muslim scholars, as well as the Sunni and the Shia scholars, that the words of Imam Ali are most definitely words greater than any man. The Nahjul Balagha, the Peak of Eloquence, the words of a great man, the words of the adopted son of the Holy Prophet, the words of the first divinely appointed Imam, the words of the living miracle of the Holy Prophet, Imam Ali. Truly, we find that the Nahjul Balagha shows us the universal